KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
What Trump cannot do through the processes of politics, he does through the processes of force.
What's the larger strategy behind the fight over immigration enforcement in Los Angeles?
Today is Monday, June 9th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. This hour, we'll look at the significance of a president deploying the National Guard over a governor's objections.
Also, Trump's latest travel ban takes effect today.
The reaction to this one is very different from his first.
Later, a novel plan to stretch the water supply in a Utah desert.
The math problem is all the water has been used. It's been called for. But yet, we have one of the fastest growing communities in the Western United States.
And takeaways from the Tony Awards.
To those who don't feel seen, to those who are being targeted, in these authoritarian times, I see you.
First, the newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The Trump administration is set to deploy about 700 California-based U.S. Marines to Los Angeles in the wake of protests against immigration raids. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports the Marines will support about 2,000 National Guard troops already there.
U.S. Northern Command announced the 2nd Battalion, 7th Marines, will send troops stationed in 29 Palms in Southern California to protect federal functions and property in L.A. After days of demonstrations against the Trump administration's crackdown on illegal immigration, the president ordered National Guard troops to the city in spite of California Governor Gavin Newsom's objections. Newsom says the troops have little to do and that police have the situation under control. California is suing the Trump administration over the decision. This was the first time since the 1960s that National Guard troops have been deployed to a state without a governor's consent. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
Meanwhile, as California Governor Gavin Newsom announces his lawsuit, things continue to ratchet up between the two men. Newsom, in an interview with NPR's All Things Considered, accused the administration of looking to incite violence.
Well, he's sowing more division, more chaos. He's inciting just the same, and more fear, more anxiety, and more likelihood that people are going to be hurt. We're on the other side of the red line. This has little precedent in modern American history.
Man, at the center of some of the protests, SEIU union leader David Huerta, who was arrested over the weekend, was freed today on $50,000 bond. Things do appear to be growing more tense in Los Angeles, with National Guard troops in a face-off with protesters at this hour. The CEOs who run America's companies and employ many of its people are trying to manage all the uncertainty created by President Trump's tariffs and other economic policies. NPR's Maria Aspen reports business leaders are now cycling through the five stages of tariffs grief.
It started with denial. As President Trump first announced some of his tariffs, CEO confidence soared to a three-year high. But now it's plummeted in its worst drop in half a century, according to the Conference Board. Some CEOs have moved on to anger and depression, while others are trying to encourage the administration to do more bargaining with trade partners. Jamie Dimon runs JPMorgan Chase.
I would engage with China. You know, I just got back from China last week. They're not scared, folks.
Meanwhile, some of Wall Street's top economists are warning that the U.S. is at an elevated risk of a recession, meaning that we all might need to practice acceptance of an economic downturn. Maria Aspen, NPR News, New York.
Stocks ended the session on a mixed note today, lifted in some cases by shares of both Amazon and Google parent Alphabet. The Dow closed down a point. However, the Nasdaq was up 61 points. The S&P rose 5 points. You're listening to NPR. Ukraine's Air Force says Russia launched nearly 500 drones overnight in one of the biggest overnight attacks of the now three-year-old war. An estimated 20 missiles were also launched by Russia. Russia's largely targeting civilian areas of Ukraine. The UN says since the start of the fighting, more than 12,000 Ukrainian civilians have died. The latest actions are coinciding with a renewed Russian battlefield push. United Nations summit hosted by France and Costa Rica opened in the French Mediterranean city of Nice today. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports more than 60 heads of state are in attendance, along with thousands of scientists and policymakers.
Scientific research boats, including a Norwegian three-mast tall ship, are part of the summit, which is taking place on the port of Nice. Scientists say the world's ocean problems include rising seas, plastic pollution, overfishing, and the destruction of marine species and environments.
This planet would be far too hot to live on if we didn't have the ocean.
That's Lisa Levin, a scientist and professor at the University of California, San Diego. She says the ocean regulates the climate by absorbing most of the heat from the atmosphere, provides food, and much more.
People recognize how important it is to the health of the planet.
Levin and other scientists are calling on summit leaders to turn their recommendations into concrete actions. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Nice.
Crude oil futures prices reach multi-week highs today as investors await more news on possible progress in terms of U.S.-China talks. Oil rose to $67.12 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The last time a president deployed the National Guard over a governor's objections was more than 50 years ago. Over the weekend, President Trump did just that in California. He ordered 2,000 National Guard soldiers to Los Angeles, where people are protesting federal immigration raids. California's governor and LA's mayor both say they don't need or want these troops to manage the protests. And today, Governor Gavin Newsom said California is suing the Trump administration for what the governor called an unlawful action. Trump appears to be relishing a showdown with a blue state over a central piece of his political agenda. Here's what he told reporters at the White House today.
The people that are causing the problem are professional agitators, they're insurrectionists, they're bad people, they should be in jail.
He presented no evidence that protesters include professional agitators. For a bigger picture of the strategy playing out here, let's bring in national security expert Juliette Kayyem, who was a Homeland Security official in the Obama administration. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you for having me.
When do you think it's appropriate for a president to bypass a state governor to deploy the National Guard?
The president's authority to federalize the National Guard has been limited in the past to when either a governor does not follow law, as we saw during the desegregation cases, or when a governor asks for it because their own resources are depleted. But we didn't see that this weekend. We saw a president look essentially at cable news, see a few cars on fire, and decide to federalize National Guard troops under the command of the governor and put him under the command of himself.
We heard President Trump there refer to the protesters as insurrectionists.
Yeah.
He has not yet invoked the Insurrection Act, but he still might. What would invoking that law empower him to do?
The Insurrection Act is essentially a way for a president to militarize first responders. I mean, that's essentially what it would be. It would be you're deploying the active military because of an insurrection or unrest to quell civil society. That might be necessary in an instance that you can think of maybe in the future. That is not what happened here. I mean, the reason why we have police departments, emergency management agencies, fire departments, is because sometimes there is unrest. Sometimes there are riots. Sometimes peaceful protests turned not peaceful. But the idea that you would say, well, there's just unrest, therefore I'm going to either federalize the National Guard or worse, deploy under the Insurrection Act active military members, think the Marines, the Air Force, into urban society is essentially the total end and erasure of this, you know, civil military distinction that has governed our country for a very long time.
Let me ask you about something that Vice President Vance posted on social media, which might point to the administration's strategy here. He wrote, "One of the main technical issues in the immigration judicial battles is whether Biden's border crisis counted as an invasion." He writes, "So now we have foreign nationals with no legal right to be in the country, waving foreign flags and assaulting law enforcement. If only we had a good word for that," end quote. Can you parse the argument he's making here, and do you think it's a valid one?
I'll start with the second question. No, it is not valid. This is an administration that knows what words to use, and they're using them for potentially a future case, whether they are going to invoke the Insurrection Act, or as we've seen already, they're going to be challenged in court by Governor Newsom under the Title 10 authority that Donald Trump used. So they're putting out language that is going to protect them, I believe, in any future legal proceedings. They have so lowered the floor at this stage on the standards that most rational people would use for unrest or riots or even insurrection, that we have to assume that is purposeful.
And so what do you make of Governor Newsom's argument that this is on its face illegal and that the president exceeded his powers? Do you agree?
Yeah. I don't know how he's going to do in court. I mean, part of it is because there's not a lot of case law here, because we've just never seen this before. So he may have a case. In other words, the president doesn't have unfettered ability to simply federalize the National Guard. Title 10 talks in terms of words like unrest, insurrection, civil unrest, but those have not really been well defined by courts. And once again, an issue that could have been resolved if only the federal government viewed its role as supporting first responders and de-escalating difficult decisions is heading to court. And that, again, will lead to new doctrine.
Finally, what is happening in Los Angeles right now is obviously different from the administration's crackdown on higher education or on law firms. But do you see parallels with the way the executive branch is using the tools it has to target centers of power that Trump perceives as standing in the way of his agenda?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I have been thinking about this weekend, that it all seems similar, that what Trump cannot do through the processes of politics, he does through the processes of force. And that is what we're seeing, whether it's contracts, whether it's a certification of educational institutions or punishing them for having international students, or going after a governor who he clearly does not like. It is that brute force rather than negotiation through processes that already exist that leads us to court again and again and again. But this instance is very different. The military deployment in society, where people are allowed to protest peacefully, where there are important debates about what this country is and who we want to be, you add a military into that calculation, and it's not a future I really like seeing. It makes me worried.
That is former Assistant Secretary at the Department of Homeland Security and current professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, Juliette Kayyem. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
American bullfrogs, which were once confined to much of eastern North America, have exploded around the world with dire consequences for native species. Now researchers say they may have found a way to help that affected wildlife rebound. Here's NPR's Ari Daniel.
Sydney Woodruff has spent multiple summers hiking to a remote corner of Yosemite National Park, where she's camped out next to ponds and lakes.
At night, you have, the moon reflecting off the water.
Inevitably, the dark quiet is broken by an American bullfrog.
Like, hum, hum, kind of noise that they do. Once one starts, another one starts, and then it becomes this like big, deafening chorus.
Woodruff, who's an ecology PhD candidate at UC Davis, remembers flashing her headlamp over the water and seeing a constellation of eyes blinking back at her, reflecting the light.
The bullfrogs were there by the thousands upon thousands.
But These frogs were not supposed to be there. For decades, people introduced them outside their native range, including in Yosemite, where the amphibians mounted an invasion of swaths of the park. And these frogs, they're massive.
Maybe the size of a grapefruit in your hand, and they will literally just feed on anything that fits into their mouth.
Like salamanders, snakes, frogs, small birds, and rodents, and
pond turtle hatchlings. We sometimes refer to them as little cookies because they're so cute.
The northwestern pond turtle is California's only native freshwater turtle, a species that's nearly vanished from the West Coast due to several reasons, one of them being the American bullfrog. The national park previously conducted a massive bullfrog eradication effort in Yosemite Valley, in part for the pond turtles. But it was too late. The turtles couldn't stage a comeback. At the remote bodies of water that Woodruff was studying, though, the situation was different. There were still some older, larger turtles, and
the only time that we are coming across young, small turtles is when they are popping up in these bullfrog stomachs. So you have no younger individuals coming up through the ranks.
Woodruff wanted to know if the bullfrogs from these backcountry ponds were removed, while there were still older turtles present, might the population show signs of recovery? So she and her colleagues did a combo of night surveys to remove the adults and day surveys
to go after those bullfrog egg masses.
Across two sites, Woodruff estimates they removed some 16,000 bullfrogs, a near complete eradication. And after multiple years,
we came across our first couple of small pond turtle hatchlings and juveniles swimming out in the environment. So once we removed that heavy bullfrog presence, those younger turtles were free from that predation and able to grow up.
The researchers also spotted certain snakes and newts making a comeback.
You see what the food web looks like and how it should look like, right? With no one species really dominating.
Woodruff says the study offers a potential tool for restoring freshwater ecosystems under certain circumstances. The results are published in the journal Biological Conservation. Kylie Gregory is a PhD student in wildlife conservation at the University of Georgia who wasn't involved in the research.
It was encouraging to see that it's effective, but this northwestern pond turtle goes from central California up to Washington. That's a lot of area to remove bullfrogs.
And she says keeping bullfrogs out requires near constant vigilance, so wildlife managers will have to be strategic.
Maybe it's parts of the population that are really important for genetic diversity, or it's high-quality habitat. Maybe that's where we really focus our efforts.
Meanwhile, in Yosemite, Sidney Woodruff says there's been a partial return to an earlier soundscape.
As the bullfrog population went down, you started to hear some of our native chorus frogs again.
In other words, once the bullfrogs croak, the native frogs can finally croon. Ari Daniel, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. From Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere. At uma.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. This week, NPR is exploring how climate change impacts where and how we live. In the American West, water scarcity, population growth, and climate change are on a collision course. One desert community in southwest Utah has a plan to stretch its water supply by reusing sewage. KUER's David Kondos explores what it'll take and what it means for other cities in the West.
It started with a simple equation.
The math problem is all the water has been used, it's been called for, but yet we have one of the fastest growing communities in the Western United States.
Zach Renstrom manages the Washington County Water Conservancy District in St. George, Utah. And in 2021, this sun-drenched outdoor recreation hub was the fastest growing metro area in the country. But an answer to its math problem may now be taking shape. Renstrom points to a maze of rebar and concrete that's slated to become a new wastewater recycling plant by the end of this year. It'll take sewage and clean it with screens, bacteria, and UV light.
So basically the water will come into there.
Reusing wastewater is the biggest piece of the district's long-term water plan. In all, it'll cost over $1 billion. Renstrom knows that's a lot of money for a place with 200,000 residents.
But now we're getting to the point where even small communities like us, it's our only option, and so we just have to do it.
More and more Western cities are facing this dilemma as people keep moving in and climate change makes heat more intense and rain less reliable. A visit to St. George's main water source, the Virgin River, highlights the urgency.
This is it. This is the lifeblood of the entire region.
Doug Bennett is the district's conservation manager. Now, this river may have carved the canyon in nearby Zion National Park, but after a dry winter, it's shallow enough to walk across without getting more than our ankles wet. In addition to reusing water, St. George and neighboring cities have adopted rules nearly eliminating grass on new development. The district pays residents to rip out their lawns, too. Making growth sustainable here will be a tall task, but Bennett believes it can work. He saw it in his previous job at the Water Authority in Las Vegas.
I have to have a lot of faith that it is absolutely doable because I've already experienced that.
Just 120 miles to the southwest, Vegas is St. George's glitzy neighbor. And it's been reusing wastewater on a large scale for decades.
So the rake is going down right now.
Bud Craner with the Clark County Water Reclamation District opens a tall door. Behind it flows some of the 100 million gallons of Las Vegas sewage his plant treats each day. It smells like you imagine.
Right here is all the poop from every casino, every business. It's like every little 12-year-old boy's dream is working at this place because you get to make poop jokes all day.
But for a city in the desert, it's no laughing matter.
What we do here is absolutely vital to this valley's survival.
Squeezing clean water from this sea of, well, you get it, has allowed the metro population here to more than double in the past two decades. And Stanford University water researcher Nusha Jami sees a growing trend of smaller communities following Vegas's lead. When it comes to scaling up wastewater reuse, she says the technology is not the limiting factor.
It's often a policy problem or a sort of governance structure that needs to change to embrace some of these solutions.
So how much reuse will let a city grow is up to its leaders, its budget, and its willingness to adapt.
You can do it smart. For example, if you build new buildings, new homes, and say, okay, you know what, we're going to connect the shower water to toilets.
The plant being built near St. George is a sign of the changing times, too. Renstrom says it wasn't too long ago that the biggest question about sewage was how to get rid of it.
And so in my career, That has completely changed, where now people are fighting over this.
And communities like his are counting on it to sustain them into a hotter, drier future. For NPR News, I'm David Kondos in St. George, Utah.
And for more climate solutions, listen all this week and visit npr.org/climatechangeweek.
Support for NPR's Climate Solutions Week, Rethinking Home, comes from the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone, and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR.
Some years, a musical at the Tony Awards sweeps across the categories and is crowned the clear winner of the season. Think Hamilton. Last night at Radio City Music Hall, no single show dominated. NPR's Jennifer Venasco was there, and she says this might seem less exciting, but it means good things for Broadway.
There was, of course, a production that won Best Musical.
And the Tony Award goes to Maybe Happy Ending.
This lovely, technically innovative show about two robots who fall in love won a total of 6 Tonys, including Best Book, Best Score, and Best Leading Actor in a Musical for Darren Criss.
Today the air in Seoul is very clear and warm. Today the smiles too are warmer than the norm.
But after that, the awards were kind of all over the place. The other major acting awards for musicals went to Buena Vista Social Club, Operation Mincemeat, and to Sunset Boulevard's Nicole Scherzinger. The same was true of the plays. Purpose, which earlier this year won the Pulitzer Prize, also won the Tony for Best Play and another Tony for Carrie Young for Best Actress in a Featured Role. But Best Direction, that went to Sam Pinkleton for the queer farce Oh Mary, and Best Leading Actor to its star, Cola Scola. And the other acting awards went to different shows, Sarah Snook for The Picture of Dorian Gray and Frances Jew for Yellowface.
To those who don't feel seen, to those who are being targeted in these authoritarian times, I see you.
The awards were spread out because so many shows were so good this season, and they were so different from each other. Heather Hitchens was on the red carpet before the show. She heads the American Theater Wing, which founded the Tony Awards. She says the special sauce of the season was diversity in its broadest sense.
Comedies, tragedies, dramas, musicals, you know, rock musicals, classical musicals. When you have something for everyone and you have those diverse voices, it ultimately leads to success in everything.
But it's not just about diversity. Actor Kristen Chenoweth, best known for Wicked, wasn't up for an award this year, but on the red carpet, she called herself a theater nerd. She says Broadway's best work comes from taking risks.
I love the revivals. I've done a couple myself, but it's very, very brave to do new work. And I really want us to build up the new work and encourage it more and not be afraid of, oh, what if the critics, what if the people? No, do new work, have something to say.
Over and over, people at the Tony Awards had this message. Do work you're passionate about, and the money will come. As host Cynthia Erivo sang, sometimes all you need is a song. Jennifer Venasco, NPR News, New York.
This is NPR News.
A Colorado neighborhood that lost homes in a wildfire rebuilt in ways that are more fire-resistant.
It's about being prepared for disaster in general and making your community safer.
Learn about home hardening as part of Climate Solutions Week, plus the latest on protests of immigration raids in the Los Angeles area. That's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
We'll be right back.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. President Trump's latest travel ban takes effect today, and there are big questions about how it'll work.
We don't know, when we hear the news, what's going to happen next with this administration, with this president.
Plus the new sci-fi series, The Eternaut.
After these headlines.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. California's Attorney General Rob Bonta plans to file a lawsuit against the Trump administration over the deployment of National Guard troops to confront immigration protesters. It's the fourth day of demonstrations affecting a small area of downtown Los Angeles after a series of immigration raids. As the state attorney general seeks a court order to halt the troop deployment, the first by a president in 60 years. U.S. Senator from California Alex Padilla says the administration has been anything but forthcoming with its immigration actions.
We have a crisis of Donald Trump's own making. The increasingly aggressive and cruel immigration enforcement tactics that they've chosen to do, of course, is going to lead to a response in communities like Los Angeles, where you have a lot of passionate people speaking up for fundamental rights and due process.
Despite today's mostly peaceful demonstrations, the president has ordered 700 Marines and even more National Guard troops to Los Angeles. Hundreds of scientists at the National Institutes of Health have issued a document criticizing cutbacks at the agency. NPR's Rob Stein has that story.
More than 300 scientists on the NIH's sprawling campus in Bethesda, Maryland, just outside Washington, D.C., sent the Bethesda Declaration to NIH Director Jay Bhattacharya, calling for him to protect the agency. The name of the document refers to the Great Barrington Declaration, which Bhattacharya helped write during the pandemic before he was at the NIH, questioning lockdowns and other public health measures during the pandemic. The Trump administration has cut hundreds of NIH staff and slashed billions in NIH funding. Rob Stein, NPR News.
Stocks finished mixed on Wall Street as China and the U.S. began trade talks in London. This is NPR. Funk music pioneer Sly Stone has died at the age of 82. He was the eclectic frontman of the influential band Sly and the Family Stone. Brandon Gates reports.
Sly Stone was born Sylvester Stewart in Denton, Texas, to an ultra-religious family. When he was 8, he formed a gospel band with his siblings. In the 1960s, Sly Stone co-founded Sly and the Family Stone. Sly Stone was known for his innovative blending of psychedelic rock, soul, jazz, gospel, and Latin. His music reflected the cultural and social upheaval of the 1960s and early 1970s. The band broke up after producing more than a dozen hits. Sly Stone became a recluse, but later in life performed in public, occasionally with his daughter. For NPR News, I'm Brandon Gates.
Warner Brothers Discovery is splitting into two separate companies, dividing cable and streaming services. This comes as the number of consumers cutting the cable cord has created upheaval in the entertainment industry. The cable company, Time Warner, will include CNN, TNT Sports, and Discovery in the U.S., while HBO and HBO Max will become part of the streaming and studios company. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services, from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. President Trump's latest travel ban went into effect today. It restricts citizens of a dozen countries from entering the U.S. He passed a similar prohibition his first time in office, but the reaction this time has been different. NPR's Jasmine Garst covers immigration. Hi, Jasmine.
Hi.
Remind us which countries are on this list and why were they banned?
It is a long list. 12 countries fully banned, including Haiti, Afghanistan, Iran, Yemen, Libya, Sudan, and Somalia. And citizens from 7 other countries will be subjected to partial bans, including Cuba, Sierra Leone, and Venezuela. Now, these are countries that the administration has deemed a threat to national security or public safety. And this ban builds on the ban from Trump's first term, which was upheld by the Supreme Court.
The president signed this new travel ban last Wednesday, but there has not been the same outcry that there was the first time he did something like this in 2017. What do you think changed?
Well, I reported on those massive protests back in 2017. People might remember them better as the so-called Muslim ban. The mood has shifted tangibly this time. Over the weekend, I spent time in a Yemeni community in Brooklyn, and the folks I met there didn't want to talk on record. I was told point blank, we are afraid, and that makes sense. The government has sent a very chilling message. Speak up, and you could get arrested and deported.
Is it possible that the travel ban is being overshadowed by the protests we're seeing in Los Angeles against immigration enforcement and the government's response to those protests?
Well, yeah, detainment and deportation are the big issues nationally, but people have been out to protest this ban. On Saturday, I was at a small vigil for Yemen in Manhattan. Kathy Breen is a retired nurse. She's 77 years old, and she told me this.
I'm here out of desperation. Is just beyond comprehension. I don't know what to say. We make refugees, but we don't take them.
And she thinks another reason people aren't showing up more is that there's just too many things to protest.
I think it's people being overwhelmed. We don't know when we hear the news what's going to happen next with this administration, with this president. But what I still can't accept is that we don't say no.
And Ari, I should add that I'm hearing real confusion about how exactly this ban is going to work.
What do you mean by that? What are people telling you?
Well, I spoke to people in the Haitian community in Miami. Haitians have been really hard hit by the Trump immigration crackdown. And human rights activist Gerlin Joseph from the nonprofit organization Haitian Bridge Alliance says folks who are legally in the U.S. are worried.
They don't know if it will be possible for them to travel with the Haitian passport, even though they have a U.S. visa. Because of the ambiguity of this announcement, nobody's really sure.
So there's like a sense of paralysis in the Haitian community. I mean, even for those who have valid visas, the news today is absolutely nerve-wracking.
Because I'm sure many people who are in the country legally have relatives who are back in their home country. And this means
absolutely
they won't be able to visit them? Yeah,
absolutely. She was telling me that there's people who had plans to visit. She knows people who had plans to visit in Canada, and now they're staying put.
That is NPR's Jasmine Garst, who covers immigration on the latest version of the Trump travel ban taking effect today. Thank you, Jasmine.
Thanks for having me.
Late last month, the Trump administration said it would begin to aggressively revoke visas from Chinese students with connections to China's ruling Communist Party or who were studying in fields deemed critical. That has sent tremors through the U.S. scientific community. NPR's Emily Fang reports.
David Ho is a celebrated virologist whose many accolades include the Presidential Citizens Medal and Time Magazine's Man of the Year for his work on HIV/AIDS. Now he's studying COVID.
Two major pandemics that plague humanity in the last 45 years or so.
And his research, Ho says, is groundbreaking because he can hire the most talented students from all over the world, including from China.
maybe the average American doesn't realize that much of the scientific workforce is comprised of foreign scientists and Chinese scientists.
Dr. Ho himself is not from China. He was born in Taiwan. But Dr. Ho sees no problem hiring Chinese postdoctoral researchers.
And the very, very best generally stay in America and contribute to America. So that party affiliation, to me, hasn't played a role at all.
The Trump administration argues some Chinese students are a threat to national security, and they accuse China's Communist Party of stealing American research. Nicholas Burns, the U.S. ambassador to China until earlier this year, points out the U.S. already screens Chinese students very closely.
If a Chinese citizen has connection to the military or the intelligence services, certainly we don't want those people in the country, in our country.
A connection to the Communist Party, Burns argues, is not a very accurate measure of a student's intentions.
And to essentially say to those people, largest country in the world, along with India, you are hereby excluded from the United States if you have any connection whatsoever with the Communist Party, I think that's short-sighted.
The exact impact of the new policy will depend on how broadly the administration applies its criteria to pull back visas. But those working in science and technology fields say the announcement has already had a chilling effect.
Yeah, fear is rampant.
This is Ken Ono, a science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM, advisor at the University of Virginia.
The damage I'm most worried about will be those students who just choose to leave because they no longer feel welcome.
Joseph Tucker is a professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He also co-directs a scholarly exchange program with China. And he says his research could not happen without students from China. Not because university labs like his prefer foreign students, they simply choose people who are the best in their field.
If you were a CEO of a company, who would you hire? You'd hire the best people that are available.
A lot of Tucker's research is related to public health issues specific to North Carolina. American citizens, he argues, benefit when researchers from around the world work side by side in the U.S.
It's a public resource, and all of our findings are published in open access journals, so anyone can see the research findings. They're presented to the public.
Dr. Ho, the virologist, says there is now a brain drain away from the U.S. Starting in the first Trump administration, he has already seen a precipitous drop in Chinese students asking to work in his laboratory. Instead, he's receiving a new kind of inquiry.
Whether I would be willing to take a position in China or in European institutions, they know what's happening in America at this time.
For nearly five decades, the U.S. educational system was venerated within China. Though going forward, Dr. Ho warns, perhaps no longer. Emily Fang, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The Berkeley Art Museum and Pacific Film Archive houses one of the world's largest collections of African American quilts. BAMPFA has 3,000 of them, and as NPR's Chloe Veltman reports, the long-term care of these delicate artworks is now in jeopardy.
Quilts are designed for everyday use. They're usually stored in people's homes and easily exposed to mold, insects, and other destructive elements that cause the fabric to degrade over time. That's why the quilts in BAMPFA's massive collection can only be put on public display after an extensive conservation process. Curator Elaine Yao explains.
Batches of quilts get placed into an enclosed chamber
and treated with carbon dioxide gas for 5 to 7 weeks.
And then they're individually vacuumed,
spritzed with an antiseptic surface cleaner,
and then very carefully folded and rehoused in acid-free tissue and boxes.
The museum is doing all of this because these quilts are important. Yao says the artworks date back to the 1860s and tell the stories of the people who made them. They were bequeathed to the museum in 2019 by a late collector who'd stored them in his home for many years.
These are beautiful artworks that can be enjoyed from an aesthetic point of view, but how they're really significant is thinking about how we regard the history of everyday Americans.
Among the 100 or so quilts Yao has chosen for display in the museum's upcoming exhibition is a striking piece by quilt artist Alice Neal. It features a portrait of Neal's mother at its center, fashioned from scraps of a dress she owned.
And the woven hat that she wears actually detaches to reveal a portrait of her mother with a silk headscarf.
A $460,000 federal grant from the Institute of Museum and Library Services, or IMLS, was meant to cover a large chunk of the museum's quilt conservation. But in early April, the agency cancelled it, along with grants it had already dispersed to hundreds of other cultural institutions. Julie Rodriguez-Widholm is BAM PFA's executive director.
I wasn't surprised, but reading it in black and white was shocking.
IMLS said in a statement to NPR, the agency is redirecting funding towards programs that, quote, inspire the virtues of patriotic citizenship to help President Trump usher in the golden age of America. Widholm says roughly half of the quilts still need to be conserved. Her team is hoping foundations, corporations and other entities will step in to make up for the loss. But it's a race against the clock.
We can basically continue conservation work through December. After that, we do not have funding to continue. And there is urgency to doing this work. Textiles are very fragile materials.
Sean Buffington is the interim president of the Henry Luce Foundation. The New York-based grantmaker gave BAM PFA roughly $150,000 towards conserving its quilts. Buffington says he wants to do more for cultural groups currently facing federal funding losses, but the hole is too big.
When you look at the resources that even IMLS, which is not a huge agency, puts into the arts, you know, that is not something that we can compensate for.
21 states filed a lawsuit in April against a Trump executive order that called for the dismantling of the Institute of Museum and Library Services and other agencies. A federal judge then put grant terminations on momentary hold. The Berkeley Art Museum and Pacific Film Archive says while the lawsuit is pending, it has no choice but to proceed as if it won't get the money back. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Kicking the tires and looking under the hood are typical steps when people buy a used car. Taking a closer look at the odometer should be part of the regimen, too. Several states are reporting a sizable increase in odometer rollback fraud. Chuck Kornbach of member station WUWM in Milwaukee reports.
A few months ago, Dan Adams wanted to buy a used car for his 16-year-old son, who's getting his driver's license. Adams lives in Illinois, about 40 miles south of the Wisconsin border. He went online and saw an ad for a 2015 Ford Explorer, posted by a man who lived about an hour away.
It says he was the original owner. He drove the car very little.
So little that the seller said the mileage for the 10-year-old Ford was just 77,000. Adams bought the car for $9,000, but soon noticed problems with the car's heater and a grinding sound that came when he turned the steering wheel. Now he rarely drives it. Adams found out that the seller, who lived in Illinois, was a wholesale car dealer licensed in Wisconsin, and the Ford's mileage was not 77,000, but more than three times as much at 289,000.
I felt embarrassed to talk to my son about what happened and my wife, and here I am, being the breadwinner of the family that supposedly makes good financial decisions and investments.
The Wisconsin DOT says last year nearly 6,000 vehicles in the state showed signs of odometer rollback, more than three times the year before. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration estimates nationally 450,000 vehicles are sold each year with false odometer readings. The data firm Carfax says, based on its computer analysis of car repair and oil change data and vehicle title transfers, it suspects 2 million cars on U.S. roads have rolled back odometers, an 18% increase over the last 4 years. Maura Skifalakwa with the Wisconsin DOT says one of the main causes for the increase is that the rolling back of digital odometers found on modern vehicles is pretty easy. She sits in the driver's seat of a car and feels for what's called the OBD, or onboard diagnostics port, usually used for legit purposes by mechanics.
That's where I am reaching right now and found it, of where they would connect to it.
They being fraudsters who have one of the many electronic odometer rollback tools you can buy in stores or online. Many of the devices do have legal uses too. There are other products that investigators can use to detect odometer tampering, and Skifalakwa says other perpetrators can be caught if they do a sloppy job of altering the mileage on the car's title. But she says investigating fraud can be more difficult in Wisconsin and some other states that still allow someone to get a wholesale car dealer's license. As more of those license holders purchase older cars at auctions, some illegally sell the cars directly to the public.
And that, you know, a buyer isn't afforded the same protection as what they would see if they were buying from a motor vehicle dealer who's, you know, required to do their inspections and whatnot before it can be sold.
Meantime, odometer fraud victim Dan Adams is trying to get his $9,000 back. He's going through a hearing process involving the seller's insurance company. And he says he'll gladly give up the Ford Explorer. For NPR News, I'm Chuck Kornbach in Milwaukee.
The Netflix series The Eternaut is based on a sci-fi graphic novel of uncommon staying power. Originally created as a comic book almost 70 years ago, its backstory is as intriguing as the story it tells, says critic Bob Mondello.
The opening shot is of a borrowed sailboat on a beautiful summer night. The lights of Buenos Aires twinkle in the background as three high school girls who've been drinking more than they should raise a toast to all the beautiful things that await.
Brindemos por todas las cosas hermosas que nos esperan.
As they hug, they don't notice the lights of the city blacking out behind them. They're looking the other way at a strange green glow in the heavens.
¿Qué es eso?
The boat begins to rock, and one of the girls pops below deck, discovering their GPS isn't working. Neither is her cell phone. She looks out a window and watches horrified as both of her friends collapse. The last thing she sees, a single flake of snow. In the city, when the electricity goes out, some old friends who've gathered to play cards chalk it up to yet another power outage until they hear something.
Shh.
They go to the window and see ashes falling?
Parece ceniza.
Could it be snow in summer? They realize as they watch cars crash and people dropping in the street that something out there is toxic. One of the card players, Juan, tries to call his daughter, but nothing electronic is working, so the others scramble to turn an old gas mask, waterproof clothing, gloves, into some sort of protection, and Juan heads out, looking like a cross between an astronaut and a deep-sea diver, into a Buenos Aires at once familiar and ghostly, walking past corpses felled in mid-gesture, two policemen chatting through a car window, a power lineman suspended high in the air, leaning back in his harness atop a telephone pole. Everywhere, a light dusting of apparently toxic snow. Chilling for any viewer, and I'll stop here just a few minutes into the first episode so you can discover the rest for yourself. These scenes have a special resonance in Argentina, where, as everywhere, people are more accustomed to disaster films set in cities north of the equator. For them, the Eternaut, or as it's known in Argentina, El Eternauta, has acquired near-mythic status since it was first published in 1957. Partly that's because it's a terrific sci-fi mystery, local and with muscular illustrations by Francisco Solano López, and partly it's because writer Héctor Germán Oesterheld rebooted the story a dozen years later, amplifying in more political terms the need not for individual heroes, but for people working together to overcome societal horror. That in 1977, during a brutal military dictatorship, Oesterheld and his four daughters were disappeared, added to the graphic novel's resonance. Oesterheld's widow was adamant that the story be filmed in Spanish and shot in Argentina. After decades of false starts, filming began in 2023, after pandemic shutdowns turned much of Buenos Aires into a real-life ghost town during COVID-19. Watching masked figures roaming deserted streets, now haunting in a freshly traumatic way. The series, with Juan, played soulfully by Ricardo Darín, Argentina's most famous actor, brings the action from the 1950s to an age of cell phones. With Argentine society currently roiled by political and social frustration, it has been well received. That was not a given, considering the esteem in which the graphic novel is held. How much esteem? Well, one subway station in Buenos Aires has been dominated for decades by a huge tile mural reproducing an Eternauta illustration, a reminder to commuters that a climactic battle in a story they've long taken to heart is fought right where they're standing. A battle not in the six Eternaut episodes currently available on Netflix, but the final cliffhanging episode notes that it's official. A second season is coming. I'm Bob Mondello.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at Viking.com. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From the NPR Wine Club, bringing people wines inspired by NPR shows. Whether purchasing a few bottles or joining the club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org.